Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Christian has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore.
To go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back NBA podcast. This is Jason Mann, and with me as always is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yeah, absolutely. This is unfortunately one that we've sort of we've gotten into rhythm sometimes of when major you know NBA deaths happen that we cover it. But I think I like that because it allows us to kind of go back and look at the careers. And we had this idea planned about 2 weeks ago when the news of Jerome Kersey's death came out, and we were saying, okay, you know, we're going to watch a full, you know, Blazers versus Celtics game. We're going to talk about how Jerome, what he did in this, and we're going to do it a different way. And then unfortunately we had two other deaths that also happened, big NBA deaths. So fortunately we're just going to kind of do touch on three careers here instead of just one fun look at Jerome Kersey. It's unfortunately going to be a few more people we have to look at, but
yeah, because after that, February 28th, Anthony Mason died at only 48 years old, and then a couple of days before that, a pioneer, the first black player in NBA history by a day, but still, you know, an important achievement, Earl Lloyd. So we're gonna look at a little bit at all three of them. First, Earl Lloyd, that obviously was the primary thing that he was known for in his career. It was October 31st, 1950, and he joined Chuck Cooper with the Celtics and Nat Sweetwater Clifton with the Knicks as the first three players to break the color line. He happened to be first because of how scheduling worked out for him, but actually only played seven games that season with the now defunct Washington Capitals. He ended up taking a year off to be in the military and then spent six seasons, the bulk of his career, with the Syracuse Nationals. They won the NBA title in 55, and he became one of the first that was the first season he and a teammate, I'm blanking on who his teammate was right now, but they were the first black players to win NBA championships. So that, of course, Adolph Shays was the key player for the Nationals during that time. But he was definitely a complimentary player, was known in his New York Times obituary, talked about how he was a strong rebounder and was so tenacious on defense that he sometimes guarded George Mikan, who was 6'10", even though he was only 6'6". And he was also a pioneer as coaching. He was the first black assistant coach with the Pistons, and was the fourth, later the fourth black head coach in history, and the first coach who was not also a player. So the first three black black coaches were all player coaches, and he was the first who was just, you know, it was after his career, he was just a bench coach, as it was referred to.
Which is pretty remarkable when you think about it.
Yeah. So
I mean, it's really cool. Like, yeah. You know, like that's, and especially in the time, and we're not in like, this isn't in like the 1990s. I mean, we're still in an era where that's, you know, your uncle might be kind of like, I don't know about it. You know what I mean? Like, that's really cool that all those guys were able to do that. And yeah, it's always been a history of the NBA in a lot of ways is yeah, it might not have been, you know, there was stuff here and there. And obviously there was, you know, racism issues in Boston and other places like that. I mean, it was bound to happen. But when you look at the history of coaches, of black coaches, it's amazing how long it goes back. And just like how I can't imagine at the time of how it sort of, you know what I mean? There's a lot to it. And Curtis Harris always does a great job in Pro Hoops history. Anytime he talks about these particular players that ended up becoming, you know, player coaches or whatever. And it's always really remarkable especially when you think of the time, like we sort of assume that, but no, I mean, it's really like, I don't know exactly how to put it into words, but, you know, 60s, 70s or whatever, we're still not at a period where I think a lot, like, you know, the majority, I don't know. I'm not living in that era. I can't say for sure, but it's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, so he, you know, was kind of careful to, you know, because he obviously, there's a comparison to Jackie Robinson, you know, as far as, you know, breaking the color in their sports. But he talked about, well, you know, Jackie Robinson faced so much more than I did. I mean, you know, baseball was, you know, the cultural touchstone at the time. The NBA was not really, you know, it didn't really have the same impact at the time because, you know, the NBA just was very, he compared it to arena football, you know, as far as like how popular mm-hmm. it was at the time. So, you know, it was still, you know, he was a pioneer and he was important. And, you know, the fact that, you know, he and Cooper and Clifton were successful led to, of course, to, you know, other black players being invited into the game. And of course, you know, the NBA is, you know, it typically dominated by black players. It's very much the game that is thought of in many circles as a black game. And, yeah. You know, so he helped, you know, lead that effort. And he made the Basketball Hall of Fame in 2003. And, you know, just had a great career. He talked about where, you know, he didn't really, like, you know, the white players, he didn't really have major issues with there. There was kind of some hurt feelings. Like there was an incident in Syracuse where they had to play, I think, an exhibition game. And there was an issue with the hotel or there was an issue where he couldn't play in the game. And he, you know, he understood that his teammates had to play in the game and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't their issue. But none of them ever, like, you know, talked to him about it or made him feel at all like at ease. And that's something like,
right.
There were slights like that, but it wasn't like he didn't face hostility from the players, but from fans, that was definitely, you know, an issue, particularly, I guess, in Baltimore and in Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, and, you know, especially, I guess, the smaller cities that the NBA was in until, you know, the NBA, you know, basically moved all the franchises to everywhere. But actually, of all places, Rochester, where the first game took place, it wasn't an issue because Rochester was in integrated, had mm-hmm. integrated schools, integrated college, and, you know, wasn't really an issue. And also, you know, the history of, you know, what it meant to history was lost in everyone because, of course, again, as we said, the NBA was not really a, you know.
Right. It wasn't America's pastime. Right. It wasn't, you know, what every kid aspired. You know, it was still just sort of, like you said, arena football is a great, unfortunate comparison to think sure. of it as that. But sure. yeah, no, it was. I mean, that's let's be honest. I mean, yeah, integrating baseball is a way, way, way bigger deal. And not to, you know, discredit what he did. Obviously, it's still a big deal. But yeah, yeah. I think we can understand with context what it means.
Right. I mean, in faced, both ways. Yeah, so. Jackie Robinson obviously just faced, I mean, it was just, you know, a huge milestone for just what he faced and going into baseball and everything. And so I like that he, you know, I mean, obviously Earl was very proud of his accomplishment and, you know, but he was willing to give, you know, like, he didn't overstate it, you know, he was willing to give credit to what it was. So, yeah, I like that he had 4,682 points in his career. He retired ranked 43rd in career scoring, you know, which is interesting to think about, you know.
Good God.
Yeah. It's just how, of course, you know, how the game has changed over the years. So that's about it that we have for Earl. We kind of put his together a little bit later. Curtis Harris reminded us, like, oh, yeah, he's an important guy to talk about, too. So we wanted to give him his props. So, next we're going to talk about Jerome Kersey.
Lefties, Walt Frazier looking on, always dapper. Wilkins with 41. This is Jerome Kersey, a late entry. My dark, he comes in from the baseline, the good leap over, throws it through with authority, comes up creativity in this contest to try and get the appeal of the judges. Like that. Jerome, she said Dominique got all excited here, wanted to be in, but I'm sure his team's happy he's not. Not bad from Jerome Kersey. Yeah, fool me once. Jerome. Let's pick up now. Here's his replacement dunk. Neal's 96 for Jordan. On the part of Jerome Kersey, who with late notice coming into the competition replacing Dominique Wilkins has done a nice job, and they give him a
four. Before we try to begin, what are your memories of Jerome Kearse as a playing? Because a lot of my memories are I've seen video and I've seen that, but I don't know if I remember profoundly a lot of his when he was playing or when, you know, he was there, or maybe I just didn't really notice him because, you know, as a kid I was obviously watching the NBA, but I was less intently watching it, more just watching for the spectacle of it, and less of like that guy's, you know, here's what this guy is or whatever. And you know, he's not one that you're gonna really that really jumps out to you as well, because that's one of my thoughts is when I was kind of going through and doing the research of him and looking up was, yeah, I mean, looking at it now and watching highlights, great player, all that. At the time, I don't know if I really noticed him all that much. Even on those Spurs teams, I think it was hard for me to really notice him. How about you? Were you kind of the same?
Yeah. You know, honestly, yeah, I was more, you know, kind of a casual fan in the nine, you know, during the bulk of his playing career. So I, like, you know, I knew the name and, but, you know, honestly, some of the other guys, for whatever reasons, stuck out of those Blazers teams. I mean, Drexler, Buck Williams, because of the glasses, the goggles, Kevin Duckworth, yeah. Because of the size, and Clifford Robinson, I guess, because of the headband, you know, all those guys kind of came before mm-hmm. Kearse to me. So,
I was no Cliff because of the Michael Jordan shrug.
Yeah.
Cliff is just in the background like, man, I can't do anything.
There,
like,
you go.
Oh, man. Like, so that's how I always remember him. That's you just right. See his face and he's just like, come on.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
Can you just miss one while I'm guarding you?
Yeah. Like, so, so he wasn't like a guy, you know, like, he was more of a name that I knew, but not anyone I'd really like explored or thought much about his, you know, career, you know, until he passed away. But yeah, I mean, he was really, you know, I guess really just like the combination of power and athleticism kind of stands out to me. I mean, he was really I had no idea he competed in so many dunk contests and, you know, finished second 1 year to Jordan, I think, in 87. And really was kind of, you know, was a really kind of a combination of, you know, ferocity and grace in his dunks. You know, he was kind of like compact, but was able to just finesse so much power into them.
I thought that I went back and I watched that 87 dunk contest. Jerome Kearse was pretty awesome in that. I mean, it's hard to match Jordan. And it happened last year too. You know, Dominique had a few years where it was like he was definitely the best. But it was like, well, Jordan's got the showmanship and all that sort of stuff. But man, Kearse in 87 was really good. Like, those are really, really good dunks. And like, a lot of them are. And he suffers from, you know, a similar thing where Dominique would suffer from it too. And you see it in subsequent dunk contests where sometimes the bigger guys that throw down these like really ferocious dunks, like, you don't really appreciate them in the moment. And I think the ratings are kind of lower. And then you watch sort of replays and you're like, oh, wow, that was a really, you know, a really, really good dunk or whatever. Or like, you know, there's just weird stuff that sort of happens in those dunk contests. But I thought 87, I thought he was really good in those. And I remember watching some of the replays and like, there was one that he does. I think it was his final dunk where he switches hands like twice in midair, and like, people didn't notice it when it was initially going on, and then when you watched it later, it was like, wow, he hung in the air and switched his hand like three times or whatever. But you know, that's dunk contest, so I try not to get too upset about them, because come on,
yeah,
who cares? But damn it, Kearse in 87 and Skywalker, Kenny Skywalker, can he win one? He was so good in all of them. I remember when I went back, I was like, this guy's awesome, and he never won any. He was so much better.
You know how
that stupid Jordan guy won all of them.
Yeah, you know how they had the old timers games for a few years.
Yeah,
they should have an old timers dunk contest.
That would be great, except for,
I mean, it would.
God forbid anybody blows their leg out, yeah, or like knee out.
Right.
We're suffering.
Maybe like
from
a nine,
yes.
Maybe 9.5 foot rim or something, you know.
Because, yeah, how old do you think? Who are these guys? Who's like a prolific dunker that you think could still probably throw one down that would be pretty nice?
I know Dominique. Like, I know Dominique can still dunk.
Yeah. Would it be like, is it just kind of like a tiptoe one, or do you think he really could?
I mean,
I'm very curious.
I don't know if he could do like a really physically impressive dunk, but maybe if he trained for a while and, you know, but I mean, you know,
Scottie Pippen, maybe. I feel like Pippen could probably.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I guess talking about what age we're talking about too. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. Well, and that's my question to you is what's sort of the age, like, what sort of era are we looking at?
I mean,
at?
I would think like 50 and older, you would have to kind of, you know,
yeah.
That would
like, is Jason Richardson invited or no?
Like, yeah. He's like 34. So, I think he's got
a
while.
Have you seen him play?
Yeah. He just came back, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
I don't think I've seen the Sixers since he came back, so I can't.
No, he's not a very he doesn't fly much.
Yeah, anymore, well, but, you know, it's been a couple years of injury, so.
What about Stacey Augmon? I feel like he could still.
Oh yeah, I bet. I think that's a good. I mean, who knows? You know, we don't really see these guys that much, except, you know, like, you know, random stuff. We don't see them out there being athletic. I don't know if anybody, I didn't watch it this year, but I don't know if anybody like in the Shooting Stars stood out to you as like, you know, any of the old guys who look like still.
Yeah, not really. Yeah. I mean, Neek was just kind of there.
Yeah,
Pippen,
you know,
Pippen looked okay. Pippen always it looks like he's in decent shape.
Yeah, I mean, he's not even 50 yet, or is he? Or he might just have turned
out. Yeah, he might have. If he did, he would have just
it's close.
It,
so. Yeah, so.
Let me see. Allen Houston always comes to those, and he always looks good. He always looks like he's ready to go. Yeah. But, you know, he was never really a prolific. You know, I know he was in one dunk contest, but he probably wouldn't. And now we're starting to get into, like, Harold Miner. What's Harold Miner?
There you go. Huh.
Yeah, I'm sure Harold Miner can still throw it.
I would be fascinated by an old-timer dunk contest.
Let's do it.
We can spot
come up with a hashtag, and we'll just continue to do it.
Sure,
until...
sure. Honestly, like, the one thing that surprised me is just how long Kersey played. Like, he played, like, 17 years. I mean, he's...
I had no recollection of those Spurs years that he won a title with the Spurs. I mean, I think you mentioned something in a chat and I was like, really? He did? Cause I hadn't really like done any profound research yet. And I was like, oh wow. I had no idea. Zero idea that he was on that team. And you know, he didn't play a big part, but hey, he was on that team. So that counts.
Yeah. I mean, on and off, you know, the rings is the same either way, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Ask John Sally. He'll tell you that it doesn't matter how much you play. The fact that if you got a ring, you're good. So a little bit of history on Jerome Kersey. What we decided to do with this format is we're going to look at a little bit of a quick basic history of each guy. We're going to do this for him and Anthony Mason. Then we're going to do a standout game, a game that we found that was probably his best game or one that we thought was his best game or anything like that. Just an interesting game in his career. A standout playoff series, what we consider his best playoff series. And then best season and then a few random things as well. So, you know, Anthony Mason, you could probably assume that one of them is going to be I won't spoil it, but knowing Anthony Mason, you could probably assume what one of the random topics will be. But yeah, we're going to do best season, standout playoff, best game. But a little bit of basic history to begin with Jerome Kersey. Interestingly enough, he is the only player from Longwood University ever to reach the NBA. And this was at the time that he graduated, or not great, sorry. I'm going to qualify that in the next statement. By the time he left Longwood College, it was an NCAA Division II school. So he was still able to get, he was drafted in the 46th pick in the second round, which is pretty good from being from an absolute no-name college. You're a relatively big baseball fan, correct?
Yes.
Big enough where you would know who Michael Tucker is.
Not that big, apparently.
You don't remember Michael Tucker? No. That's all right. I had a lot of Michael Tucker cards. I think that's the only reason I remember, because I was like, man, like I had like two sheets full of Michael Tucker cards. I don't know why I always got Michael Tucker, but never mind.
Yeah,
okay.
that
maybe I'm the only one.
Might have been past my time, so.
He was like early, he was like mid 90s, but he was no good. Okay. So it doesn't matter. He was also from Longwood College, but
gotcha.
long way to get to a story that didn't matter at all.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, Kersey, he graduated. Story. Yeah, exactly. Ding. Oh, folks. All right. Kersey graduated from Longwood actually in May of 2006. So it was one of those stories where he left a college and he still had, you know, two college credits left or whatever. So he went back and he got his degree and that was pretty cool. And you'll know a lot about Jerome Kersey when we kind of go through the history, but he's a guy who, a lot of really cool charity stuff. Smart man, not just a basketball player. A guy that was working in player personnel, worked as like a car salesman for a while, worked in like sales in between doing like assistant coaching jobs. Like he did everything. He lived a hell of a life for you know however long it was. October 8th, 1980 is when he was drafted. Or sorry, he was traded. This is an interesting thing I found. He was traded by the Los Angeles Lakers as a future pick. That's why I love the baseball or basketball reference.
So the pick
as he's traded.
The pick was traded more than he was traded.
Yeah, so he was correct.
Yeah.
The Lakers knew.
Right. Yeah.
They knew. No. Yeah, the Lakers, he was a future 1984 second round pick. Interesting. I kind of have a theory on this, but I'm not entirely positive. The Portland Trailblazers were given the option to swap first round picks in 1984 with the Lakers and opted instead just to keep the second round pick instead of swapping for the first round picks. To be fair, the Lakers pick was 23rd. So, I mean, maybe it was a financial thing, but.
Well, okay. So they would have like swapped, Portland would have swapped its own pick for the Lakers pick?
I think
but
so.
Instead,
well, no, I think.
Okay. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, no, it was kind of a weird. Yeah, I was wondering if you maybe could.
Like, I guess I could see, like, it's possible that a high, like, you know, like the first pick in the second round would want that more than the last pick in the first round because it's not guaranteed. I don't know if the rules were.
But I don't know if they had. Yeah.
But
yeah, I'm not sure either. Yeah, maybe because I don't know. That's odd. I don't know if you know what? Okay. I think I figured it out. No, that's a different trade. Never mind. I have no idea. I have no idea why they qualified this statement like that. I don't think Portland was ever interested in trading the second pick overall, Sam Bowie, for the Lakers pick.
No,
but,
that wouldn't have made much sense. Yeah.
No, but that's why I didn't know why they qualified that statement. So I wasn't sure. But there you go. Anyway, they had the opportunity to swap, but they just picked second round instead. Okay. So I don't know if anybody is a draft expert. Maybe they could have
like swapped the 84 one for an 85 one or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. But I thought that was an interesting little thing there. But anyway. Back to Jerome Kersey. During his 13-year run with the Blazers, he never missed more than 19 games per season, which is really incredible. You look at, he led the league, 82 games a few times. Really just always there. Like a super dependable player that just never, ever really missed much time. And even in his first few years, I think it was like barely a handful of games that he missed, which is awesome. It was like the first 9 years and he missed like a handful of games. It's really incredible what he was able to do for how long. Because you just don't get that often where guys are just that healthy for that long. I mean, usually get one, relatively big injury and he just never had it. He obviously, if you're familiar with the name and familiar with what we've been talking a little bit about, he became one of the important pieces of the Trailblazers teams that were pretty dominant in the early 90s and late 80s. They made it to two finals in 1990 and 1992, and he was, joined along with names that really stacked teams, really, really good teams, Clyde Drexler, Terry Porter, as you mentioned, Kevin Duckworth, Buck Williams, Cliff Robinson. You have a Drazen Petrovic in one of those years. You have Danny Ainge in 92. But really, I mean, my biggest thing about those teams is I just love the depth of those teams. And it was sort of similar to what happened with Portland later in the 2000s or in the early 2000s, rather, where, it's just a team that's just supremely deep. They just never could make it quite there. But just an incredibly deep team. Like you look at that, and these Blazers teams with Kersey are, I mean, they're 8-9 deep of like really decent players.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a I remember those teams. I mean, those teams in any other era would have made a finals they made two finals. I'm sure they would have won a finals. I mean, they were pretty great. In 91, they lost to the Lakers who went to the finals. They were 63-19 that year. That's probably the best regular season team they had. I mean, they just were really a tough out and until the Suns got Barkley, they were really, they had, but even after that, they still had a pretty good run for, a little while. Some good playoff appearances and some strong teams, Rick Adelman being the coach, that's kind of where Rick Adelman, made his name, the first stop where he made his reputation. Of course, he did other stops later, but that was a fun team to watch too. I mean, they were kind of an up and down the court type team, if I recall correctly. And Drexler's a guy who I think we've talked about is sort of like a little bit forgotten in his career. Was like a really, really big star and. Kind of suffers because he played the exact same time as Jordan did. And, he's compared with Jordan where he doesn't compare, but to almost anybody else, almost any other shooting guard of all time. I mean, he's right up there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned Drexler and him, the combo of him, Kersey and Terry Porter, they played together from 1985-86 all the way until 94-95. So it's a long, tenure of those three being the real key cogs of those Blazer teams. And that 94-95 team was the last year for all three men. Drexler obviously was traded mid-year to Houston and went on to win the title there. Porter would eventually join him, and then Kersey moved on to a bunch of different teams. In 1995, he was left unprotected in the 1995 expansion draft. The Blazers at that point had kind of moved on to different stuff. They had, they had a number of better players at that point, or better forwards. Cliff Robinson had really emerged as a real, real, real dependable player. You just had a few other guys. I mean, they were going in an obviously different, younger sort of direction. So there was really wasn't a ton of worry for Jerome Kersey kind of leaving. And he got picked up by the Toronto Raptors. They waived him before the season began. Then he went on to play a season with Golden State, one with the Los Angeles Lakers, another with the Seattle Supersonics, and then played 2 years with the Spurs. As mentioned a few minutes ago, he won a ring with the 99 Spurs as a role player. He averaged only 3.2 points per game in the regular season and wasn't a big part of their team, but was a substantial role player. And he appeared in 14 playoff games, but not a ton of work in those games either. It was very, kind of minimal work. But either way, a ring's a ring, and 14 playoff games is still pretty cool too. He finished career on the 00-01 Milwaukee Bucks, which is a very famous team for a lot of reasons. That team, they made the Eastern Conference Finals, but then obviously lost to Allen Iverson's Sixers. Kersey played very sparingly on that team, wasn't a big deal. Fell out of the rotation basically in February, and then barely played the rest of the year. But that's another team as well that kind of reminds me of those Blazers, a very deep team that just couldn't quite make it over the hump, but they're a lot of fun as well, that Bucks team.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
All right, a few quotes here that I wanted to go before I get into kind of the standout games and all the stuff about Kersey. Jim Armstrong, who he's from backofthejersey.com, did a really, really good tribute to Jerome Kersey that I read earlier. And I really, really, you know, it's not a site that I really knew beforehand, but I really enjoyed his work on here. And his quote that was pretty interesting about Kersey, and I absolutely agree, looking at sort of the history of him, looking at his stats, and then reading all the interviews and watching all the interviews that have come, you know, since his death. He mentioned that, as Bill Simmons coined in his book, The Book of Basketball, there were certain NBA players that you wanted in your NBA foxhole. He says, Jerome Kersey was a guy I wanted in my foxhole. And I think that's a great way to describe him. He wasn't a star by any means, but he was a really dependable player, really good at certain things. You know, you mentioned the dunking, transition, a really good transition player. And this kind of goes into another quote as well that I got from Comcast Sportsnet Northwest, Dwight James, who has covered, you know, Kersey through his entire career. And here's a few quotes he said about him. He was always trying to jump over people. He took some really bad falls along the way because he was always trying to pull off some death-defying play. And then he also qualifies it with he was the best chase-down shot blocker I have ever seen. And watching highlights bear that out. I remember you know today sort of pouring over Kersey highlights. You see this guy who in transition would just ferociously dunk it, and no matter who's in front of him. In a lot of ways, I don't know if it was off air or already on this show that you mentioned. Reminds me a lot of Sean Kemp, where if Sean Kemp got the ball and he was going up for a dunk, God willing, whoever was in his way, he was going to go for a dunk, no matter what. And, like, there's a ferociousness of that dunking, you know, style that's great. But, like James mentions, it also gets you really hurt. But Kersey was luckily, you know, never really ever have an issue there. But also the shot blocking as well, that was something he didn't have a ton of blocks. Blocks wasn't really, like, a focal part of his game. But when you watch the highlights, you see a lot of those of guys going up for layups, you know, lazy layups, and him just swatting it out and stuff. So that's one of the memories I sort of have of him, of going back and sort of watching these and some quotes that I thought were pretty interesting.
Yeah. One thing in there that I thought was interesting was the comparison to Paul Millsap, where, like, the 7-year stretch of Millsap's career is very similar to Kersey's 7-year stretch of the same, you know, the same ages, statistically. That kind of seems like a decent comparison for Kersey. Millsap isn't quite, you know, he's not. He's a pretty decent dunker now that I think about it. He's not a dunk contest level dunker, but he.
You don't think of him as that, but yeah, he's not bad.
Yeah, he threw one down a couple Hawks games ago that was pretty. That was pretty.
He's deliberate about it.
Yeah,
he waits.
Yeah.
He doesn't, like, if he doesn't have to, he's not going to. But yeah,
right. Yeah, it was a situation where, but I think Millsap's a nice, you know, a nice comparison as far as just you know, a little bit in the game, a little bit in production, and, you know, just a little bit in sort of how they played.
Absolutely. My favorite standout game for Jerome Kersey, one that I picked out, was February 12th, 1988, and that was against the Denver Nuggets. And I will qualify this for a little bit, because obviously it's the Denver Nuggets in 1980, and you're going, wait a minute, that team just gave up points out of the, you know, that's the Doug Moe teams. And we'll get to there in a sec. But he had 34 points and 20 rebounds, which is not his best game score, but I thought just his overall, I mean, just a game of both, you know, decent shooting, rebounding, you know, all that sort of stuff. I thought this was his best one, you know, February 12th, 1988. And as mentioned, this was a Doug Moe coached Denver Nuggets team. So you're probably thinking, well, you know, it's not that hard to score 34 points against them. Interestingly enough, obviously they were first in the league in pace because it was a Doug Moe Denver Nuggets team. So of course they were, but they weren't that bad defensively. And that was always something I remember, you know, reading back on stuff of Doug Moe always screaming about this. And he was a little bit ahead of his time, where people go, your teams give up so many points. And he's like, no, we score so many points too. Like, why, you're not understanding this. And, like, I remember just reading quotes and reading in books of that. He would just shout and be like, no, you're not, like, we also score 120 points. Like, we win a lot. Like, that's not the point. But people were, you give up 100 points a game, that's bad. Boo, boo, boo. But, this year, that team was sixth in defensive rating, with 106.3 was their, you know, points allowed per 100 possessions, which isn't great, but, I mean, sixth in the league, not, you know, not anything to slouch at. And interestingly enough, in straight opponents' points per game, they were only 19th out of 23. So, not, like, yeah, they weren't a great defensive team, but not bad. I mean, that's a pretty good. I mean, that's something I always faulted D'Antoni teams too, where everybody's like, oh, look at how many points they're giving up. And it's like, well, no, we're also scoring a lot. Why don't you?
Yeah.
But, you know.
And it was more like the Doug Moe teams. I mean, they definitely had their reputation for, you know, just for scoring it up and down. But I think it was really even like more of the Paul Westphal in their early 90s teams, where they genuinely were like, giving up records. And they were also like last in the league in defensive rating. I mean, it was just.
Yeah, those insane. Guys, that team was reckless. Yeah. Those Westphal, they were. Yeah,
but most of the 80s Nuggets teams were, you know, they were either solid or good on defense, and
I mean, you would get some ridiculous games with them. Yeah. You get some, you know, record breaking games or whatever. Right. But by and large, they were pretty good and they were winning a lot. I mean, yeah. It reminds me a lot of the George Karl Nuggets as well. Is that it's like that style. I mean, yeah, we're gonna run and gun and we're gonna win 45 games. So sure. Cool, yeah. Like let's do it. So. Yeah. I thought that was his best game. Standout playoff series, I picked the 1999 Western Semifinals versus the San Antonio Spurs. I mean, Kersey, we mentioned some of his career numbers, but these are well above 21.4 points per game, 9 rebounds per game, and an average game score of 16.2. So we had a really, really great series. Most importantly, the reason I picked this, though, Game 7 of that series, Kersey had a gigantic game. He had 21 points, 16 rebounds, and 6 steals. I thought the 6 steals was really interesting. And obviously knowing that, you know, they went on to win the Western Semis that year and go into the NBA Finals where they would meet the Detroit Pistons and, you know, the vaunted defense or whatever. But I thought that was a real good series, and it stood out to me as being his absolute best one, held up by that Game 7 performance where, you know, there were, especially if you look at that game's you know, Drexler wasn't playing all that well. I think it was Porter or Drexler. One of them was not shooting well. It was something, they were like 3 of 11 or something like that. So Kersey going in there and you know, picking up the scoring load and those 6 steals are really awesome. And yeah, I mean, it got him to the finals. So that's pretty cool. So I would say that was probably their best season. I went with 89-90, which fittingly enough matches with the standout playoff series. He had a 16 points per game that year, and his career high was 19.2 in 87-88. But I thought this year as an overall year was a little bit better. He had a career best 8.4 rebounds per game, career best 4.7 defensive win shares, a career best 8.8 win shares in total, and a 3.6 value over replacement player, which was also a career best. So he, you know, his scoring wasn't quite, you know, what it was in 87-88, but everything else was better, from defense to rebounding to everything else. So I thought that was a pretty interesting year to pick. And then obviously it matches with the standout playoff series. You know, he has a great playoff run, you know, has a great Game 7 in the Western Semis. They go to the NBA Finals. They obviously don't win. They lose to the vaunted, you know, Detroit Pistons or whatever. But he has some pretty good games in there, including Game 4. He has 33 points in a Game 4 loss, unfortunately. But, yeah, I thought that was his best overall year. And I think the finals, you know, appearance sort of lives up to that as well. So that was one that I picked. There are a few other things I decided for my randomness. I decided fouls, and that's, I kind of called this section fouls, and Jerome was not shy at all about grabbing fouls, and that might be a lot of the chase down blocks, you know, that the Comcast Sports Network Northwest guy said that he was great at chase down blocks. And I don't know what it is. I mean, without pouring over the game, you know, the game data and all that sort of stuff, I have no idea, but he had a lot of fouls. He averaged 3 per game over his career, 3.2 during his Blazers tenure. And then I did a little bit of play indexing just to kind of see where he ranks all time in terms of guys, you know, in fouls and minutes. And of players with over 20,000 minutes, so this is over 20,000 minutes played, only Danny Shays, James Edwards, Rick Mahorn, Caldwell Jones, Kurt Thomas, and Sean Kemp, interestingly enough, have more fouls than Kersey per minute played. So he got his work done in not many minutes, but a lot of fouls. I mean, he doesn't rank historically all time in fouls just because he obviously doesn't have, you know, the minutes that a lot of guys do. You know, guys that played, you know, a big, like a guy like Shaq or whatever is near the top, or Will Chamberlain or those guys, sure, who just played, you know, ungodly amounts of minutes. But for his minutes played and fouls generated, he's right up there with the NBA greats such as Kurt Thomas. So,
yeah.
Yep. And then the last section I did, and this is the thing, if you've been watching the tributes, if you watched any video, if you've read anything about Jerome Kersey, you know, since his death, the biggest thing, and the header for this one, I put legend on and off the court, because people talk about, yeah, he was this and this for the Blazers, but he meant so much more to the community of Portland. And that seems to be the prevailing thought with Jerome. And when I was going through, I was trying to find people talking about his game. And unfortunately, I was having a tough time because everybody would sort of say, yeah, he did this for the Blazers, but here, let's talk about this. Let's talk about what he did. And that's kind of cool. I mean, I'm perfectly okay with that. For the purposes of this, I would have probably liked a little bit more of, hey, describe to me how he played. But it's really interesting to see what he sort of did in the community. He was the Trailblazers at the time of his death. He was the Trailblazers alumni ambassador. So he did a bunch of stuff with the Blazers and with their organization. He was an ambassador for the Children's Cancer Association. He had done that for the past 5 years. He also worked for Habitat for Humanity, Caddies for Cure, and then he also developed the Trailblazers Boys and Girls Club and several other local organizations. And that's the biggest thing you hear in all these interviews, and even when they're mentioning their coaches, and even when they talk to guys like Terry Porter, Drexler, whatever, they talk about what he did. You know, he was great. He was a tenacious. He was a great teammate, all this sort of stuff. But let's talk about what he did off the court. He did so much. So great to see that. And unfortunately, he died so young. But definitely had a great life. I mean, like I said, he did so many things in his life. In addition to, you know, becoming the first player from a kind of a no-name school to make the NBA, to playing there, to being a journeyman, to winning a ring, to, you know, being an assistant coach in Milwaukee with Terry Porter, to being, you know, like I said, a car salesman. And then he worked in the office of the Trailblazers, you know, did so many charities, did all the other stuff. Just really cool. And there's an interesting quote here from the Children's Cancer Center Director of Development. It was at Jenny O'Brien. She says, for the little ones that couldn't reach the basket, Jerome was the first one to scoop them up and put them up so they could shoot a basket. He just had a really wonderful way with kids. So
sounds like a great guy. Yeah,
absolutely. So,
and I, you know, they talked about you linked to it, but there's a, you know, an article by Ben Gulliver at SI talking about, you know, just how, like, you know, he was active in the organization and how, like, the organization, you know, the Blazers had, you know, responded to the, you know, death at 52, you know, was shocking because of his age and, you know, because of the swiftness of it. And
they had all seen him earlier in the day, which was kind of chilling too, when it's like one of the guys was like, you know, I just gave him a hug and said goodbye. And like, I had no idea, you know, that was it. Like,
he a blood clot issue. So, just, you know, a huge surprise. And of course, the news kind of came out before, you know, they could confirm that it happened, and having, you know, just the process of, okay, did he really die, and getting together with the family and making sure everyone's notified before they can put out a statement. And it's just, you know, not that that's like the biggest issue, you know, of all that, but it's just, you know, thinking about how challenging it would be for an organization to sort of, you know, to handle that, you know, it's, my hearts go out to them, you know, everyone who's been, you know, who's lost him and been affected by that.
Absolutely. And yeah, that's a really good piece. It's Ben Gulliver. I forgot the exact title of the piece, but if you look at Ben Gulliver, Jerome Kearse, you should be able to find it pretty easily. He just does a great job of painting the picture of why it was such a big deal. I mean, like, people were just shocked in the Blazers organization, and it just shows what sort of impact he had is how big of a deal it was to everybody there. It wasn't just a, oh, you know, what's Jerome been doing? Like, he had just an important piece in that organization to this point, and was just an absolute legend. They have a great tribute video in the story too about him and all that other good stuff. So, unfortunately, had to talk about it, but still a great life though. I mean, I think he. Not, you know, not knowing, or, you know, it's easy to say, but I think he led a pretty awesome life. So,
yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think we'll take a little bit of a break, and then we will come on back and talk about Anthony Mason. Back, and we are ready to talk a little bit about Anthony Mason, who I think would be sort of the best known to modern fans of the three guys that we are talking about. Of course, his most famous years with the New York Knicks in the early to mid 90s, but, you know, he really, you know, he kind of had an interesting journey. To start off with, he was, you know, he grew up in Queens, and he was part of a New York basketball scene along with guys like Mark Jackson and Kenny Smith and a lot of guys who didn't make the NBA, but those two, you know, kind of were contemporaries of his. Ended up playing at Tennessee State University. It's sort of a thing that all three players that were talked about have in common. They all came from small colleges. Earl Lloyd played at West Virginia State. I forget if we mentioned that, but they all went to small colleges. So, and he was a journeyman who drafted by in the third round by Portland, but they as you mentioned, a stacked deep team. They didn't have room for him, so he went to Turkey. Then he played like 21 games with the Nets. Then he popped off to Venezuela. Then played had a couple of 10-day stints with the Nuggets. Then went to the Tulsa Fast Breakers of the Continental Basketball Association, and then the Long Island Surf of the USBL, United States Basketball League, I believe. So that one I'm not even sure I've heard of. I mean, I think I've heard of it.
I don't know much.
I know about the CBA, but I don't really know nothing about the USBL.
I've seen the acronym, but I couldn't tell you if I knew one thing about that league at all. Someone needs to. Is there a book out there that just goes like breaks down these little odd leagues? Somebody make that.
There's a couple of CBA books. I know that. I haven't read them.
Okay, I'm gonna have to look them out because I'm fascinated by the CBA.
Yeah,
fascinated.
There's a couple of that are regarded as pretty good. So
okay, I'll have to seek those out.
Yeah, and so 91-92 season, he caught on with the Knicks. Pat Riley, who had just become coach there, was looking for a tough-minded physical player, looking to kind of create that identity that would rough its way around the league. And he was definitely part of that with, Charles Oakley and Patrick Ewing and other guys, and similar to John Starks, not in the sense of the physical toughness, but in the sense of coming from these humble origins of, bouncing around the, and making their way into the league. And he sort of grew into a bigger role with the Knicks as they had memorable playoff runs. They had a lot of big series against the Bulls and the Pacers, and they also went to the finals in 94, losing to Houston in Game 7. He was the sixth man of the year in 94-95 season, but he had a few spats with Pat Riley where he ended up being suspended for a few games. That happened two seasons in a row. Also had some legal trouble involving fights with police, and later had a sexual assault allegation that was pleaded down. Had some anger not only on the court but some issues off the court as well. Eventually was traded to Charlotte before the 96-97 season, but by then he was about 30 and ended up having playing a bigger role and really thriving. Charlotte had some pretty good teams over those years. They never did much in the playoffs, but they were definitely they were a fun team that they had Glenn Rice, David Wesley, Muggsy Bogues. You had some good shooters, Del Curry. That later got Baron Davis and Eddie Jones. And
he spanned both those teams too, which is kind of fun about that, is that he wasn't just, he spanned sort of, and you'll get to it a little bit, but he spanned that like the Baron Davis era, but then also spanned that mid 90s one too, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah,
you don't think of him as a Hornet as much. I mean, I don't personally,
right, but
think of him as much as a Hornet as a Nick, but had a pretty long and pretty profound career with the Hornets.
Yeah, he had three full seasons. He was hurt in the 99 lockout season. He was injured, so he didn't play that year, but he was, on the team. Then moved on to Miami Heat, reunited with Pat Riley, and ended up having his first and only All-Star season that year. But then they decided not to bring him back, I think partly because of his age and not wanting to give him a big contract. But then he was 34 that year. And then he ended up moving on to Milwaukee, who had gone to the Eastern Conference Finals the year before, but they were a big disappointment. And he started having issues with conditioning and such and was out of the league a year later. So that is, those are the basic roundup of everywhere he went in his career. And, I think one thing, the thing that stands out to me is, obviously he played he played the point forward thing that he did throughout his career. I mean, he really had a mix of, being a big man with guard skills and having that sort of that, both the grace and the skill along with the toughness and the power. Like, he's another guy. I mean, I knew him better than Jerome Kersey, but I didn't, like, my memory of him was more like, I remember, the grinded out Knicks teams that beat everybody up. And I remembered him, being, just a, muscular guy.
I just remember him shoving people.
That's exactly.
That's like,
right.
I thought he never, I never even assumed he ever touched the ball. I just assumed Michael Jordan went up for a layup and then he just shoved him. And that's Anthony Mason is all I remember of Anthony Mason. And then getting in a fight, somebody coming over and pushing him. And that's all I remember is just him getting in fights and pushing Michael Jordan.
Yeah. And so, he did that, but he had really, really, really great footwork. He handled the ball. Later in his career, he helped facilitate the offense was really had great skills as a guard. I think the thing that he lacked, he wasn't much of a shooter. He got better at that aspect later in his career, but that was kind of the thing that kind of kept him from being a superstar. He had just about everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he conditioning was also a thing too. Even as graceful as he was and all that sort of stuff, you always kind of saw and like even when you watch those Hornets highlights where he's facilitating the offense or whatever, he's still kind of just and it was to his benefit too because he was great at backing guys down and really great at that. So his girth was sort of what helped him, but there were also times too where you could tell it was sort of, you know, maybe possibly holding him back. But that's a double edged sword because it was also what made him, you know, so powerful as well. So who knows?
When he was younger, he was just cut. I mean, he was just, you know, incredibly muscular. I mean, he was described in an SI article from 92. He's a hybrid, upper body by Michelin, legs by the Rockettes. So
it's good.
That's a pretty good one. Yeah. And, you know, there's another SI article from 98 where talking about, you know, kind of the development of his passing. And, you know, he's with is with Charlotte at this point. And he said, although he rarely considered giving up the ball as a youngster on the New York City playgrounds, Mason has become a student of post passers, particularly Charles Barkley. You see how Charles baits people, then finds his open shooters, he says. He takes pride in it, and it shows. And he loves to pass so much that he's been known to grouse when the Hornets fail to run their offense through them. And that was one thing that was kind of like throughout his, you know, particularly with the Knicks, like he really wanted to have a bigger role in offense, and that was just something that he was rarely able to get. That was a big, you know, fight with Pat Riley on give me the ball. I want the ball more. And then in his last season in New York, Don Nelson took over. He coached for about two thirds of the season before he left, and they put Jeff Van Gundy in. And there's a quote from Derek Harper, you know, his teammate for a few years with the Knicks. When Don Nelson loves a guy, you know he's versatile, and he loved Mason. Nelly took me off point and put Mace in there and told me to trust him. I did, and it worked. Mace found open people. He looked like a linebacker, but his quick feet and his agility were really special. He made a lot of bigger guys look small when he played against them, which is
and that was Derek Harper. I don't know if you qualified.
Oh, I think I did. Maybe.
Oh, did you? Okay, in case you didn't, that's Derek Harper.
That was Derek Harper.
He's the one that was taken off point. So Derek Harper was.
Oh yes, to be clear. Yes.
No, you're good. No, I just want to make sure. I don't know if you. I don't recall if you said it or not.
Okay.
But.
Yeah. Listen, Rich. Listening. Like Derek made like Derek Harper did to Don Nelson. You got to listen.
Exactly. Right. Yes. He listened.
So that's sort of his skills and watching the video. I mean, really just is, that skill really did stand out. For a standout game, I picked a 2000 game against the Raptors in which he had a triple double. He had a career high 31 points, 14 rebounds, 11 assists. And Toronto and Charlotte both had nearly identical records, 40 and 32 and 40 and 31 for the Hornets. And they're both battling for, you know, playoff positioning in the East. And so this is an important game. And so Mason is and they talked about in the video where Paul Silas had like officially made him, you know, basically their point guard going on point forward, just basically to help solve a log jam in the front court so everyone could get their touches. And also, you know, running the offense through him opened things up for other guys. I mean, they had David Wesley as their point guard, who if I recall correctly, was kind of more of a shooter than he was.
Yeah, he was a good shooter. Yeah. He was more of a shooting guard. That was always the problem with the Hornets team. And then you had a guy like Baron Davis, who's
he was a rookie.
Also kind of, and he's a rookie too. And he was also kind of like, yeah, I can pass, but I'm really good at scoring. So I was like, are you sure? Like, so it's actually, it was a smart idea. Good on Paul Silas to do that. Cause neither of those two was really, really great point guards. They were better scoring guards. So
yeah,
it worked.
Exactly. Yeah. And they had, you know, Eddie Jones was on the team. Eldon Campbell, Derek Coleman, although they didn't play in this game, was on the team. Those were kind of the key players. Brad Miller was on that team too. Although I don't think I saw him at least I didn't see him in the highlights of the game. I don't think he played in this game either, but that might've been the year he got traded. Now that I think about it, he may have been a midseason trade. Yeah. The guys who play are the guys that we mentioned, plus Chucky Brown, Eddie Robinson, and Todd Fuller. So
I saw you made me watch those highlights, and I saw Eddie Robinson, and then I cowered.
Oh, yeah, that's not great.
Why did you make me remind me of Eddie Robinson?
So, you know, I mean, just really it showed, you know, off his great ball handling and passing for his size. He scored a lot on his old teammate, Charles Oakley. defended Vince Carter well. That was, you know, another thing where his defensive versatility, and we'll kind of get into that a little bit more in the standout playoff series, where he could defend someone like, you know, he could defend Carter, he could defend, you know, basically four positions in his prime. So and, you know, great post moves both in scoring and in passing. So, you know, obviously, you know, getting able to get down there, being able to find the open shooters, and also, you know, being able to score when needed. So definitely great there. So the standout playoff series, there's a lot of them, you know, because he obviously was, you know, he was part of, you know, when you're playing New York, people are going to remember the New York series just because, you know, that's where it happened. And, you know, the Bulls and the Pacers series, you know, there's some real good ones from 92 through 95 there. But I chose the 94 finals versus the Rockets, where, you know, statistically he did similar numbers to kind of what he normally did. But he was just kind of able to sort of I think the thing that stood out to me was that how much he guarded Hakeem Olajuwon and how relatively effective he was at doing that. You know, even though he was a bit undersized to be doing that and to, you know, but Olajuwon couldn't move him. You know, I mean, he really actually was, although he wasn't as tall, he was, you know, thicker than Olajuwon, I guess.
Yeah.
Like Olajuwon wasn't quite as like thick then as I kind of remembered him being, you know, like, I mean, he was muscular guy, but he was a little bit more, I mean, that's part of like his talent is he was like lithe and graceful, but he was,
yeah,
you know,
right. How much did he weigh? I'm always kind of, 255 it says.
Okay.
So. And Mason, by that point, if when he was 25, he was 250. I would venture to guess he was a little more at
maybe
this point.
Like 260, 270, I would guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. So that's okay.
Yeah, he didn't look like he did in his Charlotte years where, you know, there was.
Yeah, more, he was still okay.
Well, right. But
he's 6'7". I mean, he's 3 inches shorter, yeah. And, you know, 10 or 15 pounds heavier. So
exactly, yeah. So
it's a big deal.
And he guarded Derek Harper. And this is Harper is mentioned in a Bleacher Report piece by Rick Bucher. He guarded Olajuwon, Otis Thorpe, and Robert Horry all in that series. So, and that series went 7 games, you know, it was very close to a Knicks win. So several of the games were very close. So it was definitely a, you know, definitely a good performance for him. And, you know, his numbers were, I mean, they were, you know, kind of what they were usually in his career line. He played almost 30 minutes, per game, 8.6, points, 6.9 rebounds, you know, nothing, not exceptional, you know, but he definitely had more standout series later performance wise when he played in Charlotte. But, you know, as far as just kind of encompassing like a kind of a mix of everything that he did, I think this Rocket series is a pretty good one to pick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great pick. It's a fun series to relive as well. I know I've not that long ago looked at highlights, and it's maybe the games themselves are not that exciting, but it's fun because it's just different teams in the 90s. You kind of get bored. And even me, I get bored of like, you know, 90s highlights because it's just like, it's just Jordan and like Pippen. And like, they're just, but so when you get this, it's like, oh my God, it's like a different team in the finals. Yeah. Like, that's pretty cool. Like, that's always, I always like watching this finals, and I always was a big fan of these finals just because it was something different.
The biggest, point differential at the end of the game was 9 points.
Yeah, like they were all like super close games too, which I remember all the way through seven games.
Seven,
so
eight,
a lot of fun.
7, 8, 4, 9, 7, 2, and 6.
Wow.
So, I forgot the Knicks were up 3-2 in that series.
Yeah.
Yeah. That might be a good podcast one to
let's do that.
Yeah, I think that would be a
good one. I can laugh at the Knicks fans.
There you go.
We could bring on a Knicks fan and I will make fun of them.
Oh, no. You know, we don't want to do that.
My rings that I clearly won as
you
a
do
Bulls,
yes
because I live in the same city that they play, so that
them.
Means I won them, so
yeah,
you know,
count the rings.
Right. I have a shirt with them on them. Does that count?
There you go. I
have a hat. I have a shirt and a hat.
You can literally count the rings on your shirt, so I believe that counts.
Right, that's what I mean. We'll do a video chat and I will go look
rings
six
rings yeah.
Yeah. Z with a Z.
We,
two Zs.
As many Zs. As many Zs as you possibly can.
I guess six. Yeah, I guess six Zs, right?
That would make sense to me.
Do you use as many Zs as your... So like Boston Celtics fans have to just
have
like...
17 Zs, yeah.
They can't even like tweet it because it's just, it uses too many characters.
Or 18. I forget how many that was. It's not important.
What is it?
It's either 17 or 18. I think it's 17. Okay. I think the Lakers have 16. I think that's what it is.
Okay. That sounds right. Yeah, I thought it was 16, but that's the Lakers. You're right.
Yeah
I have no idea.
It's not important. Someone.
It is. No, it is.
Someone
it
might
is.
Correct us, and if they do, but, you know, good
care.
For you. But his best season was his All-Star season in 2000, 2001. Reunited with Pat Riley. He was the second oldest first-time All-Star in history, 1 month younger than Nat Sweetwater Clifton, also a African-American pioneer in basketball. And that was the year that Alonzo Mourning had his kidney ailment and was out for the season. So he ended up playing center for more almost half the season. So he played, he played the center position, but he never, had played. He'd either been a power forward or small forward, throughout his career, played most of his minutes there, but he played almost half of them at center that year. And, he averaged 16.1 points, which was just barely off his career high. He had 9.6 rebounds, 3.1 assists, and had his highest usage ever in his career, exactly at 20, which is kind of funny. Average. He had a real strong season, had a best PER, his best very, very close to his best win chase for 48. It was slightly off from a year in Charlotte. But so one thing I didn't mention specifically is that he played more than 3,000 minutes for six straight seasons, which I don't think would happen now. But that's like a, and every season from the Knicks on through Milwaukee, he played no fewer than 73 games.
It's like he plays for Tom Thibodeau.
Yeah, so. Right. I mean, he played crazy, a lot of minutes, and, although he lasted till, 35, 36. So.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. We're ragging on, his athletic shape and all this sort of stuff, and he's like, I'm good.
Yeah, he's fine. Well,
fat doesn't pull. I think, John Kruk that said that from baseball? I was like, you can't pull fat, so there you go. I mean, it's wrong, but he doesn't understand how muscle structure works, but yeah, we'll go with it. So.
Well, I try to get all my anatomy lessons from John Kruk. I feel like that's good advice. Right, yeah. Exactly. So, the Heat didn't end up, they didn't do anything exceptional in the playoffs or anything. They lost in the first round to the Hornets, as a matter of fact. Actually, Anthony Mason had a history of his team of losing to his previous teams in playoff series. That happened like two or three times in his career. So
it's a very interesting team. I'm sure you've looked at the roster of these guys. There's a lot of really interesting folks on this team that, but not like the profound, like the big guys are like your Eddie Jones, your Anthony Mason, your Brian Grant, your Tim Hardaway, Alonzo Mourning for as much as he had. Then it gets weird. Then you get a Bruce Bowen in there who Cedric Sabalas is still there. Thunder Dan Marley. And then my best combo, which I can't imagine how I get. These guys are still super young at this point, so I don't know if they were total idiots at this point, but Ricky Davis and Eddie House were on the same team.
Yeah, it's funny that Ricky Davis and Eddie Jones both followed Mason from Miami to Charlotte. I don't think there was a trade.
Were they in the same trade? Yeah, I wonder.
I don't think it was.
Let me look that up. Yeah, I have no idea if they were.
I didn't think Mason was traded. I thought he was signed to the free agent.
I thought so too. Yeah, that's why it's interesting. Trying to look here at the career of, where are you, Ricky? You didn't play much.
Maybe it was a sign and trade. It was Ricky Davis, Dale Ellis, and Eddie Jones for PJ Brown, Rodney Buford, Tim James, Jamal Mashburn, Otis Thorpe.
Okay, so they were. Because that made too much sense that they would all, all three of them, hey, yeah. Let's all sign with the Heat.
Right, yeah. So.
They'd be pretty cool, but yeah, okay.
There you go. So.
The Ricky Davis.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it more on a Ricky Davis podcast. Yeah. Coming next week. I believe that's what we're doing for that next week, right?
For Ricky Davis week? For
yes, Harvard, yeah, we already recorded it, right?
Yeah, I believe that would, yeah, that would make sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
We're not. It's we're joking.
Yeah, maybe
soon. Soon.
Yeah, I'm sure that's definitely in there. So, the other thing that I kind of picked is for my random thing was sort of how he reflected the Knicks, the city of New York, and sort of the changes that happened in 1990s basketball. I don't know. What are your feelings on on those Knicks? I mean, just sort of separate it from your not being necessarily a big fan of the franchise and just,
yeah,
like what do you think?
Separate it from your irrational hatred of the New York Knicks, but
right.
No, and I get my irrational hatred from this team because growing up or whatever, obviously, I'm watching Bulls games or whatever. It was hard not to hate these. My dad just loathed these teams because they would play them. And obviously I was a little too young for those Detroit Pistons years. So I probably would hate them more. But for me, it was growing up and watching those Knicks teams. And I think the biggest thing for me was they just played such an ugly brand of basketball that it sort of annoyed me as a kid, because I would sit down and watch and they just weren't that fun of games. I was like, no, like, come on. Like, they were more deliberate than I really wanted to at that time. You know, I really wanted kind of a quicker pace when I was watching. And to be fair, I mean, looking back now, a lot of the 90s basketball wasn't, you know, that. It was very deliberate and very kind of slower. But the Knicks sort of encapsulated that a little bit. No, I mean, overall, I mean, I enjoy those teams, but they're ugly teams. I mean, we have a running joke. My friends and I, we play the NBA 2K game, and you know, we do random teams sometimes. We do random classic teams. And whenever you get those Knicks teams, it's the worst, because you just cannot score with them, because they just have no scoring options. You give it down to Ewing, and if Ewing doesn't score, you're just like, ay, damn it. Like, who else do I score? And that's sort of always the thought I remember of them, is they played an ugly brand of basketball. They played, you know, sort of a rough and tumble brand. It was for its time, it was interesting. And then it sort of, I think I hated it a little bit more, because then, you know, that we talk about 98, 99, 2000, 2001, and that just, every team was doing it. It was just like, oh God, like, you know, it just sort of became what Eastern Conference basketball was sort of represented as, you know, later in the 90s and through the early 2000s. So I'm much a bigger fan of what we have now and what we've had prior, but I get that was important. And to be fair, a lot of it was to counteract, you know, how good Michael Jordan was and how good a lot of these high flying guys were. It was like, look, you know, we don't have the talent. You know, in a lot of ways, they maximize what I would consider kind of a lack of talent. Those teams, I don't know if they're that talented.
Yeah.
But they were able to do a lot with it.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, the guy who, you know, of course, became known for, you know, coaching Showtime, you know, ended up kind of leading.
I love that. Yeah. I love that aspect of a guy who changed and said, okay, look, that's why I sort of mentioned the talent. Cause it's like, look, when I had Magic and I had Worthy and I had that, yeah, I could run and gun. I'm not doing that with you guys. Like we're an ugly bunch of guys. Let's play an ugly brand. Like, you know, like, we have guys, like you mentioned, like a Starks, who was kind of a journey, you know, Anthony Mason, who's a journeyman. He was able to fit those guys into those roles and make it work. And that's a testament to Pat Riley a lot, and a testament to those guys, to all buying in to that style.
And Riley also, you know, inherited Showtime, you know, so, you know, and then he kept it going, because obviously it worked, but he, you know, I guess more naturally he was kind of that the 90s were more of kind of a reflection of what he was, or what, you know, what he kind of believed in as a basketball coach, which is interesting. Yeah, I think there's one there's a March or November 1994 New York Magazine feature that was linked from Dan Devine at Ball Don't Lie. And it's got a great quote from Pat Riley. Anthony's what I'd call an oxymoron. He defies expectations. As a player, you look at Mace's size and court demeanor and think he's a blue-collar banger, and he is, but he's also very nimble, can outrun people, and has superior ball-handling skills. He's deft, almost cute. There's a bundle of contradictions about him. He's versatile, unique in that way. And then there's one little line added, maybe too unique for his own good. And I think that's a decent way of summing up Anthony Mason.
Yeah, because he annoys the hell out of me.
Right, so yeah.
I said all this good stuff, but he still annoys me, so I want you to print that. So.
Yeah. You know, the New York Times obit talking about where, you know, he had a fearsome court persona, gave hard fouls, glared at opponents, badgered referees, and never shied away from a scuffle in or away from the arena. His aggressiveness sometimes spilled over into a forearm to the throat or an elbow to the ribs. So just, you know, talking about the, just, you know, that was, you know, kind of how they played, kind of, how they, you know, just, I think he best reflected the Knicks of that time, you know, and it, you know, maybe in a sense, the Knicks were almost like a little bit of a correction to the high flying 80s in a sense, like mm-hmm. That was just, you know, it was like kind of like the next wave that needed to happen for basketball to evolve, even though it got ugly for a while. Maybe it was what we needed to kind of get, you know, to the game to where it is today in a sense, you know.
Because then we sort of follow that up with, you know, the running gun Mavericks and the Suns or whatever. So it's ebb and flow.
Yeah, exactly.
You always sort of have a reactionary of let's slow it down, let's speed it up, let's slow it down. It's you need that.
Yeah. So
it wouldn't be any fun. It wouldn't be any fun without
no,
it.
No. So. Yeah. And I like having, you know, I like teams playing, the different teams having different styles and you know, and different waves that the game kind of goes. So that's always kind of interesting. Even if, you know, yeah, I'm not always excited to watch a mid-90s Knicks game, but also, you know, one thing that stands out is the hair graffiti. You know, he would get things shaved into his head, like Mace or one's I'm ready. There's
the skyline.
Yeah,
there's a famous one.
Yeah, you know, or Knicks, or you know, he had a number, then there's a 90s jam.tumblr.com, a sort of a NBA in the 90s Tumblr, is you know, had a great post showing the,
which is an awesome Tumblr, by the way.
Yeah,
from the design. Yeah, the design is spectacular. If you're not, go there right now. It's the best design Tumblr ever.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome
because it's so. 90s, because it's 90s, and it's
yes. And then, you know, kind of my favorite piece talking about all of this is by Robert Silverman of Daily Beast. Robert's been a guest on our show, and talking about, you know, just kind of like how he as a New Yorker felt about the Knicks at the time, and that, you know, kind of the anger that he, Anthony Mason, had, and, you know, the Knicks kind of represented, sort of represented like his attitude and his feelings kind of about being a New Yorker and all that. And then sort of like looking at that later, as you know, as an older adult, and kind of, you know, his feelings, yeah, having mixed feelings about that. But I just, some really good thoughts there, and definitely the piece I really recommend everyone check out. We'll link to it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Although it's been around, a lot of people I'm sure have read it, but I think the best thing is that the product on the quote on the court was ugly is undeniable. It was a glowering, sweaty scrum masquerading as basketball. But that, too, seemed to be a New York response to Michael Jordan's poetry. Mean streets transcribed into the hardwood, literally. You want to score against in the paint against Mason and the equally fear-inspiring duo of Ewing and Charles Oakley? Fine, but you're going to be on the receiving end of a few scars for your trouble. And the last words I will give...
Chicago. No mean streets in Chicago.
Oh, so. Well, you know, you got to have the New York, you know.
No, I know. That's I think every team has that, because like every major city has like an area. So they always sort of mention, like, anytime there's like a hard-nosed guy. Basically, wherever Charles Oakley goes, it's like, well, he represents the hard nose of Toronto. So,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
That's fine. No, I it's a great piece. Absolutely. I just always... That's just kind of a narrative. Like, every newspaper writer does that. Like, a player that hustles and grinds is a representative of like a factory somewhere in your city or whatever. Like, everybody's got it. Like, every city's kind of the same people. It's like, it's I get
well,
it like
well I mean I don't I mean you know they're yeah this is a better discussion for later, but I get where
I want it now. No, I get what he's saying.
Yeah,
too, but
I
but Chicago wasn't really all sunshine in the 90s.
That's true. That's true. So and Raphael Canton of the NBA Trades Tumblr, who we had also had a guest in the show. He tracked down a great quote from Anthony Mason in his roundup of the Anthony Mason Larry Johnson trade. And Mason said, New York is one of those places where people get tired of you quick. The fans weren't tired of me, but management got tired. They knew I came to play every night, and that's what they paid me for. Management wanted me to be Mr. Clean, but they do their own things too. Nobody's perfect. I put myself in situations that I probably shouldn't have. If you want a person who is smiling all the time, the nicest person in the world, then I can be difficult to coach. If you want a person who doesn't vote his opinion, I'm very difficult. So just like, you know, he wanted to do what he wanted to do on his own terms.
Yeah. Got to respect that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So anything else, Rich?
Not really. Yeah, I mean, Anthony Mason, I have a lot of, you know, I remember growing up with him, but as you said, my sort of what I always remembered him as, and possibly unfairly, and that could be, you know, my age as well. And you know, obviously now that I've watched a lot of Anthony Mason, watched videos or whatever, I respect him more. But, you know, as you mentioned, you know, when we're starting this, or when I think of Anthony Mason before maybe I did this podcast, it would be the rough and tumble, the pushing, the shoving, the rebounds, that sort of stuff is what I always remembered of him. But he is a lot more than that. He was an absolutely, and especially that, if you can seek it out, that Charlotte Hornets game that you're mentioning, and I think you can look it up, like Anthony Mason, Charlotte Hornets career hires, you know, something like that, you can find it. It really shows you that, yeah, he was that to an extent, but he was way, I mean, he was just so, as that Pat Riley quote said, he was nimble too. He was like a very finesse guy, like in that game alone, and even in possessions, you see that he takes the ball up and he's very careful about, you know, who he's going to pass to or whatever. But then when it's time to post, he's just banging into guys or whatever. And then next possession, he's kind of slowing it down again and going quiet. And it's fun to see that. It's just a weird, weird vibe that you get from him, which is interesting. And it made him a unique player. And I love the stories of journeymen that become, you know, rotational guys, and especially guys that will end up becoming all-stars. I think it's the coolest thing ever is that this guy, you know, you never give up. You go to Venezuela, you go the USBL, you go to the CBA, and then eventually you make it, and then you stick, and you stick for a long time. That's really cool. I always love those stories.
Yeah. He also, he was, after retirement, was definitely heavily involved in his sons' lives. They two of his sons played basketball. Anthony Mason Jr. played for St. John's. His other son, Antoine, played at Auburn, then transferred to Niagara University, and was apparently the second leading scorer in the NCAA as a junior, behind only Doug McDermott. So, I'm glad we got a chance to, you know, talk about all three men who were, you know, in their own way, made their mark on NBA history. And it's obviously one of the fun things we like to do about this show, even though it's under sad circumstances. But it's good stuff. So. You can find us at thepodiumgame.com, where we would love to hear from you if you want to leave a comment in the on the post at thepodiumgame.com. You can also tweet us at Over and Back NBA on Twitter, and we also have a Facebook page, which you can find facebook.com/OverandBackNBA. And you can check out the Hardwood Paroxysm Network iTunes feed, which has our show and many other great shows that you can also find at the Podium Game on it. Check that out. Leave a rating and a comment on iTunes if you're into what we do, and we would greatly appreciate that. And did I forget anything, Rich?
That's it. OverandBackNBA.com. If you want, it's our blog that we're trying to get off the ground a little bit. Obviously, yeah. It's taking a little bit of time to do it, but we're going to get into a flow eventually here. Yeah. But OverandBackNBA.com, we do some blogs here and there. We talk, we do Team Facts, a series you started and I've kind of gotten into and done a few here and there. We kind of look at a team, you know, the most important players of that team, the most important, you know, figures of that team. So fun stuff there. We'll look at players,
at stuff, you know, just some trivia and some fun, you know.
Yeah, and we're gonna try to do a lot more of that, but obviously it's hard to kind of juggle time and all that sort of stuff, but it's a plan. But for sure you can go to overandbacknba.com for all that as well.
Cool. Well, thank you, Rich, again for doing this with me. I always appreciate your insight into this stuff. It's good to do a podcast with you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, everyone. And thanks for listening, and keep checking us out. We'll have more to you soon.